Hello, I'm Michael Bott.
And I'm Rupert Soskin. Welcome to another Prehistory Guys interview, talking with people making a difference in the world of archaeology and prehistory.
And today we're really delighted to be talking with Amanda Hart, director of the Corinium Museum in Cirencester. Now, despite any number of challenges over the past 6 years, including more recently the COVID lockdowns, of course, Amanda has kept driving the project of giving the museum a complete overhaul and redesign, and with her team has created a breathtaking set of galleries that cover the full span of human history in the Cotswolds.
One thing that makes Amanda so rare is that she's a museum director with archaeology in her veins. She studied archaeology at university and has been involved on excavations of the Bronze Age sites in the Moroni Valley on Cyprus. And ultimately, she turned this back to her love of museums, bringing a unique slant on how archaeology could be presented to the public.
We think that what Amanda has achieved at Corinium is nothing short of extraordinary, and this interview is our way of helping celebrate her dedication and devotion in bringing prehistory to a wider audience. We hope you enjoy our conversation as much as we did.
Amanda Hart, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the show. And how the devil are you? Apart from all the nonsenses, you've actually moved house while all this has been going on as well, haven't you?
Oh, I did. It's been just a whirlwind few years for me, particularly the last 2 to 3 years when I've been working on the Stone Age to Corinium project, the build side of the project and developing the new galleries. And last year, in the middle of all of that, I decided to move house. So I moved to a lovely little place in the Cotswolds called Nailsworth. And Nailsworth is quite, it's a quirky place is the best way I can describe it. But my journey to work now involves going up over Minchin Hampden Common. And I frequently get stopped by the cows that are on the common land. So they just wander across the road.
But rush hour in the Cotswolds.
Yeah, in the Cotswolds. So, you know, I do love wildlife. And Nailsworth is in a valley, and our hill sits at the top of the valley. So we overlook the valley from the back of our house. And, you know, it's just delightful. I just switch off Fantastic. When I see that.
Well, an extraordinary Fantastic. Achievement, moving house while this is all still going on, but an extraordinary achievement over the past 6 years. I just thought you might like an opportunity, Amanda. I mean, it's not just you, although I do get the whiff of extraordinary leadership going on here as far as getting this complete is concerned. But you might like an opportunity to acknowledge, you know, the people that have worked with you on this and creating this extraordinary new, well, it's almost virtually a new museum, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it really is. Oh, my goodness. I mean, there's such a long list of people involved in this project. I mean, I would have to start with the immediate museum team. Because, you know, none of this would have happened without the strong team that we have here at Corinium Museum, for their expertise and their professionalism. But in particular, I would say Dr. Alison Brooks, who heads up the collections team. She's been invaluable in terms of the interpretation scheme and looking at the objects and choosing those with me. So we very much worked on that together, and all of her staff beneath her have been involved in selecting objects from the archive, doing a lot of the research, all of that kind of thing. I mean, we did our own interpretation for this, so we've written all the information that you read in the galleries itself. So, I mean, it has been an immense piece of work putting those together. Also, I give special mention to Emma Stewart, who has headed up the activity plan. So because this project is National Lottery Heritage funded, there are two aspects to it. It's not just about the build itself and the new galleries. That's the heritage element, if you like. but it's also about people and communities and how we are going to benefit people and communities through this project. So we have to be able to demonstrate that. So the way that we've done that is look at how we're going to engage our audiences. And Emma wrote all of that plan and has been instrumental in delivering a lot of that work. So her and her team in the education side, exhibition side, you name it, they've all contributed to that. So I would say that's the sort of the key museum team involved in the project. But on top of that, you know, we're very fortunate here in the Cotswolds. We have a number of high profile academics that have been excavating in the area as well. So to name a few, Dr. Tom Moore, Tim Darville, and just down the road from us is Cotswold Archaeology. We have a really strong partnership with them. So I'd say Neil Holbrook, Martin Watts, who heads up Cotswold Archaeology at Kemble. It's been great talking to all of these people as well in putting the galleries together, talking to them about how they might look as well. Also, the whole project team in terms of exhibition design, the build works, you know, building, and that's the engineering side, mechanical engineering, the lighting, you know, you name it in that sense. Well, and the architects have done a fantastic job. So, yes, there's lots of people. I could go on and on.
Just before we come on to asking you about yourself and your own involvement, you know, and what's been going, are there any particular sort of highs and lows, pushbacks you know, that have occurred for you? I know, not least of which, of course, is the pandemic. Got in the way a bit, but also provided an opportunity to get things complete. I don't know. Yeah.
It's really difficult. I think because it's, again, because it's heritage funded, you go through this process where it's two phases. The first phase, which took 3 years in itself, was what's called the development phase. And you have to put forward your ideas, but in that you have to write a 10-year business plan, interpretation plan, the activity plan, and you have to go through all of that. They give you a small amount of money to invest at that point to work out your ideas with audiences, etc., etc. But at the end of that 3-year period, before you've even started building works or anything, at that point they could say no, and that's been 3 years worth of work to get to that
stage. Goodness. Oh,
and lots of projects fall down at that point. And it's devastating for people that have invested in that time. So that was an anxious moment. Thankfully, we did get through to the next phase, and that's when they give you then all the funding to actually go ahead and do the project. I think the next biggest hurdle for me was when building work started. Because of the nature of the building, it's a grade two listed building. You know, there's four buildings that join together to make up Carinia Museum. And in the architectural plans, I wanted to remove a corner of one of those buildings. So the corner is actually was in our main reception. In order for that to come out, we were quite limited in what investigation work we could do, because it would have meant digging up in the middle of our reception area. So we could only do a small amount of investigative work. When we did that amount of work, we knew that the ground wasn't great, but we came up with two schemes, structural schemes, so that, you know, if there were two different eventualities, we could go with one of those schemes. In the end, when they started to excavate to actually take out the corner of that building, it was the worst case scenario. They discovered that the building was almost sitting on a river, basically.
Oh my God.
And they were amazed at how the building was still standing.
Still standing.
So, they really were. They were saying, do you know what, you absolutely need to do this work now, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
You need to do this. But at that point, of course, they said, right, we can't, because of the nature of this, we have to go 3 meters down. We have to pile. We have to do it by hand because it's the building above is 3 stories high with a strong room at the top of the museum. So extremely dangerous. And they said, this is going to be an expensive job. They came back and it added something like £250,000 to £300,000 more onto the project. And I've done a lot of the fundraising for the project myself. And at that point, having to go back, talk to key stakeholders and get their further investment was a really stressful time for me. That was particularly difficult.
I'm sure.
I'm so glad that we have an opportunity to, you know, for people to understand the size, you know, of the task that took on and the roller coaster experience that must have been. But now, Rupert, kick off.
Well, the thing is, there is so much to talk about in what you've actually achieved at the museum. But before we get into that, I want to ask you, we always ask everybody, what on earth was it that got you involved in archaeology in the first place and ultimately brought you to be the director of a museum, for God's sake? Because you have you've excavated in Cyprus as well, haven't you? You know, archaeology was a thing before you really got into the museum side. So, tell us about that. What got you where you are?
Well, I'm going to deviate slightly. It might be a first for the prehistory guys, but because I think there's two strands to my passion. One's archaeology and the other is museums. And when I looked back on my life and how I got into this, I think the two regularly cross over and you know, come up. So I think from a museum perspective, I think everybody remembers their first visit to a museum. And mine was when I was really little. I was still in primary school and I grew up in Australia. So I was in Australia and I remember going to the Melbourne Museum and seeing Farlap, the racehorse, which was famous because this racehorse won the Gold Cup in Melbourne several times and it became this big thing in Melbourne. And if you go to the Melbourne Museum and look at what's in there, it's not a great deal, but I remember seeing this huge racehorse and being absolutely amazed, you know, the size of it and what was this thing? What was this object and why was it important? And I think that was my first experience really of the ability of museums to really infuse and inspire and you know, make you ask questions about objects. So that was my first museum experience. And because I grew up in Australia, I didn't really encounter much archaeology until I moved to Britain. And then I remember in school learning about European prehistory. And it was when Stone Age was on the curriculum. And I remember, you know, learning about Stone Age people, hunter-gatherers, and I was absolutely fascinated, really fascinated. Yeah. So that sort of got me on the archaeology trajectory. But I have to say, you know, my parents are both really into archaeology. My dad's an archdeacon. I spent a lot of my childhood going to ecclesiastical buildings, abbeys, churches, and because my dad was based at a lot of medieval churches, there were a lot of excavations actually. So he would take me along and show me what was happening as well. That was, quite an important thing in my childhood. And because we moved from Australia, initially it was for a sabbatical for my father. And initially it was for 3 years. So in those 3 years, we traveled all over Europe and visited so many museums and sites. And I just became more and more interested in archaeology as a subject.
How did you come to be where you are at the Corinian Museum?
So after I studied ancient history, and then I went on to study archaeology at university at Reading. And at the time, I was interested in European prehistory. And I was fortunate enough, there were only six of us that were able to go on this excavation in Cyprus. I went out in my first year. It was a Bronze Age site in the Moroni Valley. And we were excavating a Bronze Age house, which was stunning. You think about Bronze Age buildings in Britain and compare it to those in Cyprus. I mean, these had pebble mosaic floors. They were something else. You know, I just remember just the feeling being on excavation and finding things. You know, I found a rubbish tip that was full of oil lamps, but the most exquisite oil lamps. That was it. I got the bug, but I became more interested in artifacts. I mean, I think I discovered when I was in Cyprus, because I went back for another season, and I think I knew then I wasn't going to be a site archaeologist, because it was just grueling, really. I mean, long day. I mean, hats off to all archaeologists that work on digs, because it is absolutely hard work.
Hats off to all archaeologists. Yes. Yeah.
It's so true. So it's something we've commented so many times about the amount of after the event work, you know, with people wading through God knows how many thousand pieces of flint that all need to be catalogued and everything else. Yeah, it's true. Field archaeologists are they're special.
Field archaeologists, we salute you.
We do. Because I just thought I couldn't do it. I couldn't make a living out of this, but I became more interested in the objects themselves and what objects can tell us about, well, so many things. And so I decided that I was going to go down the route of working in a museum. And so I did a lot of voluntary work in museums, and then I did my MA in museum studies at Leicester. But I never strayed from archaeology, so I specialised in archaeological curatorship. But doing a museum studies course, it's so practical that it taught me all the different aspects of museology and working in museums, because there's so many different facets to working in a museum. And I guess all of that is what makes a good exhibition, because all of those elements go into a good exhibition. It's not just about the objects, it's about so many other things as well.
Yeah. And why particularly Cirencester? How did you come to be particularly at Cirencester?
Well, I just finished my studies and I was still working at Reading University, and I was really just looking for museum jobs, but I knew that I wanted to work in an archaeological museum. And there's not that many in the country. Choices are limited. No. So it was the first museum job that I applied for. And I got the job. And I actually came to Corinium to work as the head of education to run that department.
Interesting.
Yeah, which I did for 10 years. And then at that point, I mean, I was looking for other jobs, but I'd already decided then that I wanted to get back into collection side of things. And then the job came available here and I went for it. And here I still am. But I decided to at that point, I want to do a project. So hence I started the project.
Well, that's a perfect segue into the next question, because, you know, clawing back a bit now, then, you know, the question comes up, why the last 6 years? You know, what were the particular problems that needed to be addressed at the museum that kick-started this project into activity?
Well, I think museums have gone through quite a difficult period, really, with lots of challenges. We are a local authority museum, and you know, all our funding initially came through the local authority. And of course, at that point, government grants had been reducing. So a lot of what they call sort of discretionary services were being looked at. And certainly at that time, a number of museums were looking at alternatives. A number of councils were looking at alternative ways of delivering their museum services. So a number went out to trusts. They've set up their own charitable trusts, and others like us, we were actually put out on a contract. So we're currently on a on a contract. There were lots of different management models being looked at, but with the sort of the decreasing investment, if you like, that came with reducing staff numbers, which then came with reducing our resources. And museums really were being asked to look at their income streams. You know, you can't rely on government funding anymore. So how are you going to become viable and sustainable as a museum? So we needed to consider our assets, if you like, and look at you know, the building itself and what we could do with the building. And we also needed to consider our programming. It wasn't enough anymore for museums to just open their doors and expect people to come. You know, you just couldn't do that. So what were we going to do to get people into the museum? So that's really was the starting point for the project. And there are a number of things that I'd observed within the museum myself that I thought, oh, you know, one day if I get the opportunity, I would change this because it's not working. I mean, one of the things we have a what we call our Lifelong Learning Centre, a catchy title, but it's a space that can be used for all sorts of activity. So it can be a lecture theatre, but it has retractable seating, so then it can convert into a workspace area. And some of the new income streams with our programming that we'd tested out were things like running a cinema here in the museum, which actually really took off.
Goodness,
and it was becoming it became a really good income stream. So we thought, okay, so cinema works. Let's try live screenings of National Theatre and opera. And people couldn't get enough of these. So we were doing more things like that in that space. Yeah. But also corporate hire became a really important income stream for us. So we would have... you know, companies, local companies use our space to do their events. And then we found ourselves in this impossible position where we had this amazing space and we were turning away corporate hires because schools took priority in that space. You know, that's one of our sort of targets that we have to meet. So it was really frustrating to think we could be getting all this income and yet we don't have the space to accommodate all these different things happening in the museum. So certainly one of the central things in the project was to create a space that could be used for all sorts of other things, the school workshops, but demonstrations, work that volunteers do, all of that could happen in this new space that would be at the heart of the museum. Yeah. And the other space would be freed up. So that's just one example.
Yeah, was there a kind of a tipping point that where there was no turning back, you know, a sort of a launching point an event that happened or something that came off, you know, at what point was the decision made to go forth?
I think once I set my mind to something, I'm a starter finisher. And I'm determined.
Excellent.
And once I'd set off on that journey, that was it. I was doing it.
Okay.
But it's really right at that at the start, it's a really difficult thing, because in order to get the investment you need from somebody like the National Lottery Heritage Fund, you have to have already had significant investment from elsewhere. But a lot of other funders wouldn't invest until they got the Heritage Fund money. So it was like a chicken and egg scenario.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that was quite difficult, that first stage.
Hats off to you, because, you know, it is quite extraordinary, you know, to jump through these hurdles, to get through these hurdles and have the strength and passion to make sure these things happen. The Carinium Museum, the kind of the clues in the name a bit, and previously and it still is, Cirencester is a Roman town, and the museum is very much focused on the Roman occupation and what they left behind. But what, of course, attracted, you know, brought us to you was that we found out that you were shifting the focus just a little bit to include more about the prehistory of the Cotswolds. That wasn't to say that there wasn't a prehistory element before, but you have determined to bring it far more into focus. So what, from your point of view, was the big thing, you know, it's just your own personal passion about that, or was there something more that had you bring the emphasis more round towards prehistory and the development of the fantastic, as far as I've seen from the film, the exhibition itself, the interpretation itself?
Yeah. It's just in you saying it there that I realised that actually... There's definitely some of me in that, and that actually, yes, my passion about prehistory is probably why I chose those galleries. However, it's not the only reason. We've gone through various stages of development with this museum over the years, and the last major development was in 2002 to 2004. And in that development, the whole Roman section was doubled in size. The mezzanine level was put on. We added in a Saxon gallery at that time, revamped medieval, and then went through to the 19th century. So all of those sections were really looked at in that phase of development, which took 2 years, and that was a £7 million project. So, you know, that was extensive. So I was really looking at areas that needed development at the time. And the prehistory galleries, I don't want to say dire, that's a bit harsh, but they were old and tired. And they really, they needed looking at. And the interpretation hadn't really been looked at for, well, at that point, 25 years. So now we're talking 30 years plus. And of course, you know, as a museum, the thing that people have to realise is that we are constantly collecting. So over a period of 25 to 30 years, you can imagine, well, maybe you can't, but we have amassed a huge amount of archaeology. Boxes of archaeology. And certainly in the areas of prehistory, because they weren't done as part of the other galleries, we had a lot of material in storage that we needed to review, and we needed to get it out on display. And it just seemed the obvious thing that the prehistory galleries were looked at.
You are the depository museum for the whole of the Cotswolds, aren't you?
We are now. We haven't always been, but since I think 1976, we have collected for the entire Cotswold district.
That's just huge.
Yes. I think the Cotswolds is the largest rural district in England. I mean, it is huge, but also it's archaeologically rich. It's a rich landscape.
Yeah.
You know, we have a lot of archaeology, but we have some really important archaeology as well, and some important stories to tell from that.
Which particular sites, which particular excavations have you focused on in the museum, in the prehistory part of the museum?
So in the older prehistory galleries that we had, some of that archaeology is obviously incorporated into the new galleries. I'm just trying to think. So Hazleton North is a long barrow, Neolithic Cotswold 7 type cairn that was chosen for full excavation between 1979 and 82. And the reason it was selected for excavation is because a committee had been formed sometime in the 70s looking at the risk of these Cotswold 7 barrows, because they were being destroyed, if you like, by ploughing, and it was becoming an increasing issue. So this committee was formed to look at this, and they excavated Hazleton Long Barrow and all the contents of it. So it's around 41 individuals from that barrow.
Oh my goodness!
Wow!
Yeah.
Yeah. And around...
that competes well with some more well-known ones, doesn't it? Goodness.
Yes. Yeah. And it's a really well-known, famous long barrow. It appears on Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were racking
Indiana
our brains
Jones
earlier.
Talks about it.
That's wonderful.
Yeah,
okay.
Good grief.
So there were two chambers to this long barrow, north and south. And we have the complete south chamber reconstructed in the Carinian Museum.
Oh, fantastic.
So you can actually... Yeah,
it is extraordinary, actually.
It's extraordinary, but that was already in those galleries. It was put in there in the 80s. But it was in the wrong place. So as part of the project, we had to move this south chamber into another location so we could put the cases in. So we had specialist conservators, Clevedon Conservation, who were brilliant, and they single-handedly had to remove first all the smaller stones on the outside and then all the massive orthostats, and they had to be moved into the new location. The base of this chamber was actually structurally engineered, and there was a joke on site that you could launch a rocket off it because it had to take the weight of this chamber, which is huge weight. So we have the Hazleton archive.
Oh, gosh, that's just
incredible. Which is... it's really important because in terms of scientific analysis, all of those individuals, because it sort of demonstrates a Neolithic community, they have been analysed quite a lot by researchers. So we have quite a lot of information about the skeletal remains from this site.
Yeah. You've also got a representation of a beaker burial. Is that right, Amanda?
Yes. So, two other important sites to mention that, again, have been excavated in the last sort of 15 years. Kings Hill North. So that's just outside of Cirencester. And that site sort of runs from the Neolithic period right the way through to Roman. We have quite a lot of objects to come out of Kings Hill North, including beaker burials. And the one that we have on display in the new galleries is a reconstructed burial of a female. And she's in the usual position on her side, in a flex position, with a beaker at her feet. This is a really unusual burial because it's what's called a hooves and hide burial. And basically a cow hide was placed. They're incredibly rare.
Okay. And, oh, goodness, yes.
Yeah, and so it has the hide of a cow over the top of her.
Does that have another name? Because that was similar to the Lechlade burial, wasn't it? There was a cow hide burial there.
I think there was.
There are others. There's one in Wharton Business Park, and also you get them in Wessex. So that's the other place.
Right.
Yeah. So it's clearly, it indicates a high status female. But the others are male, so she is the only example of a female hide and hooves burial. So, okay.
Right.
Definitely that was, you're absolutely right, Rupert, the Lechlade, shaman under the cape, under the skate park fella.
Interesting. And so not so very far away, in fact, really.
No.
That's interesting in itself. Cause
yes.
Because the beaker is pretty much complete, isn't it, in that... I know it's been completely reconstructed, but but it's almost complete,
yes.
Isn't it? Entire, I mean.
Yeah. I mean, we used one of the best in the country, a conservator called Lynn Edge. She was absolutely fantastic. I mean... We sent these beakers out to her and they were in fragments. They were in bags, fragments.
Yeah,
and
wow.
She'd done an incredible job. Incredible.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So we now have quite a number of beakers on display. But there was one beaker from Kings Hill North that I just thought was too fragmentary for her to piece back together, but she did it. It's incredible. So really, really lovely items.
All these unsung heroes behind the scenes, all these incredible craftspeople behind the scenes.
Yes.
Making these things possible.
So that's another aspect, isn't it? When you were making all the new displays in the museum, you've actually made films with a lot of highly skilled creators, haven't you? The likes of James Dilley and... people, tell us a little bit about them because it's quite a bit
and
of work you did.
Tom Timbrella, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, we know Tom.
Yes. I know I've listened to your shows before, and the numbers of people that were mentioned, I thought, oh, we've used them in the galleries. Great. But they're the leading experts in their field at what they do, and we've managed to use them. But we've got different interpretive strands going through the galleries, and one of these is technologies and the change. It's an obvious one in prehistory, but the change in technology as you go through the different ages. And so we begin in the Paleolithic period, talking about hand axes and flint knapping as the very first, stone tools. So James Dilley is in a film and he shows his techniques of making a hand axe. And then we go through with the introduction of pottery in the Neolithic. And we've got, of course, Graham Taylor, who produces a grooved ware pot. And then we've got Neil Burridge, and he does a Bronze Age pulse-stave axe. And then we go through... to Tom Timbrell, who does an Iron Age knife. And then the last video is the Ermine Street Guard talking about the Roman cavalry and the arrival of the cavalry. So we've got these films. They're really lovely, actually.
But we come to an important point, Amanda, in that the Stone Age to Carinium display, whatever we like to call it, it's not just a display of the taxonomy and the chronology of prehistory. It's also access to examining for people to interrogate, shall I say, the process of archaeology itself. Do you want to say a bit more about that?
Yeah.
I know it's something quite close to your heart, that.
It is close to my heart. And, you know, I was delighted when you saw Images of the Galleries and you picked it up. And I was so thrilled because to get that across and you to realise that's the point, I was really, really pleased. Because I think for me, because I've worked in education and also, you know, in archaeology, I sometimes feel that people don't necessarily understand or make the connection between objects they see on display and the whole process that object has been through to get to be on display. And the lifetime of an object, I mean, you think some of those objects haven't seen the light of day for 25 years, but also to what happened to it prior to it even getting to that stage is quite remarkable. But I think it's really important that you show that process of actually something is excavated, it's discovered, and then it's probably in bits when it's discovered, you know, so somebody then has to piece it back together as best they can. Then there are people that might do research on an object, so take analysis of an object, and that might tell us something else about the object. And, you know, it has to be processed. Once it arrives at the museum, it goes through this processing, and then eventually it will end up on display. But it ends up on display in a way that we choose to display it as well. You know, it's within a theme, it's within a story. And it could be part of many stories, but it's in the story that we decide to tell.
Yeah.
So if you take it out of that context, for example, then its meaning changes completely.
And getting across that archaeology is not necessarily about the objects, it's not about the bling, but it's about the context itself, because without the context you can't tell any story. And that's eventually what archaeology is all about, being able to give a narrative, give a story that... is illuminating and inspiring.
Absolutely.
That wasn't a question, but
no.
one of my famous non-questions, Amanda.
you've touched on this a couple of times, but there's a lot more to say about it. I think one thing that, apart from the fact that the museum is just so spectacular now. And it'll be lovely to be able to show people some of those aspects in this. But education as well, and not just education, but the way you've actually opened it up in a much more communal way. You know, you've got different aspects of the local community that can engage with the museum now. But educationally, the amount of children of all ages that you're getting involved, you know, we've said this in places that, you know, that there is nothing more important than inspiring children, and it's something that you've put a lot of effort into making that happen. So, you know, tell us a little bit more about how the museum actually engages educationally.
In that development stage of the project, one of the things that you have to do is identify what audiences you're going to work with. So, I mean, as a team, we sat down, we did a lot of work into this and looked at, well, we know who we reach, we know who our audiences are that already engage with us. Well, who aren't we reaching? You know, who's missing out? Because these are the people that we should try and engage with. The prehistory galleries themselves opened up new opportunities. So one of those was, of course, the curriculum has changed again, and now prehistory is taught on the school curriculum once again.
About time too.
Yes. Yes. So that gave us an opportunity to do a whole series of new workshops based on prehistory, because it's all well and good suddenly changing the curriculum, but actually if schools aren't set up to to deal with this, or the local museum doesn't offer anything, then I know a lot of teachers were sort of scratching their heads and saying, well, what do we do? So that was a fantastic opportunity. So we did a lot of work with local schools and discussing the curriculum and what we could offer. So we have a range of things, because we have workshops that can happen here in the museum, but we also have loans boxes that go out to schools and they use the artifacts themselves from the loans boxes.
Oh, wow. How exciting, yeah.
Yeah, which are really popular, and especially at the moment because we can't do any workshops in the museum. So now we're having to develop a whole load of digital content as well. So we've got an alternative program for schools whilst we're not doing hands-on delivery. So schools was an important one. We also recognise, I mean, we are a very well-known family museum, but within that we didn't feel like we catered for early years particularly. So we looked at ways of working with early years. So we worked with a number of groups in Cirencester to see the sorts of things that they would be interested in. So we now have a storytelling program. We have, can you see on the wall?
Yes.
Behind me?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a tactile playmat.
Oh, yoga.
Which is a prehistoric.
I was just going to say the same. Yeah, what one? Good grief.
So the little round houses and stone circle.
Yeah,
but this is for under fives to engage with the prehistoric landscape. We've got a reconstructed round house in the galleries, and inside that we've put like foam log cushions and different things that really young children can play with and interact. They absolutely love it. So it's been really successful. Things like musical instruments, things like that.
Brilliant. Well, so, you can tell that Rupert and I have a numerical age and we have an actual age now.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. As has been observed by numbers of people over the years. Oh, good grief.
Are you able, you know, with the strength of this exhibition and the museum and the redevelopment of the museum, do you feel now that your outreach is beyond the your own locality, and you can outreach more nationally, perhaps?
I hope so, because
I mean, from the educational point of view, yeah.
From the educational point of view, yeah. I do. I mean, we do cover quite a wide area in terms of education. Schools come from all over to visit us.
We have won
awards for our That's education. But we cover all ages. I mean, I focus there on early years, actually, but we cover secondary school, college. We've got the college down the road, Cirencester College, used to offer the archaeology A-level until they got rid of it, which is a whole nother subject. But the college do offer some heritage courses, so we work closely with them. And, of course, we've got the Royal Agricultural University, which has recently started doing an archaeology degree. But we have other universities visiting as well. So we cover the whole range.
It's amazing. It is amazing. Well, conscious of time, Amanda, tell us what's next for you now. You've come to the end of this massive 6-year project. You've opened the new galleries, which are just breathtaking.
Yes.
What now?
First and foremost, I'm having a well-earned holiday because I had some really difficult moments where everyone went off on furlough and I was literally the only person here finishing the project single-handedly. Yes. So I am exhausted, to be honest, but I think after having a break, of course, the project's not actually finished because we have the activity plan that runs now for a period of time where we have to deliver a number of programmes. So we have to do that. And as one rather nice funder pointed out to me when I sent them the invitation to the launch, they got back to me and said, oh, that's wonderful, that's great. Well, we'll be expecting your final report then.
Oh, that's what you've been really looking forward to, yes.
So I thought, oh, I don't even get a day. Yeah. Now I'm going to start report writing to actually now. Yeah. So there's lots of that to do. But I think it's a moment for pause, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
To take a breath, enjoy the new galleries and really think about what to do next.
Well, what a fantastic achievement. I, for one, am absolutely full of admiration. And
absolutely. It's remarkable what you have achieved. It truly is. And you, clearly you were the person for the job because, you know, you've driven it so just with such clarity. It's honestly, genuinely, we are in awe. It is wonderful, and we very much look forward to being able to come to visit as well when everything settles down.
Is there anything you feel that we've missed out in this conversation, which we've enjoyed so much listening to as well? But is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Well, I just feel like I haven't expressed enough how important some of these objects are, and we really do have spectacular objects on display to see. So, you know, it's really well worth it.
Excellent. Well, we agree.
we shall make sure that we give people all the links for how they can you know, find your website online and things like that. Because for the people who can't come to visit readily, then it would be good for them to see some of the aspects that they will be missing if they don't come to visit.
And the good thing about not having a launch here in the museum is that we did the online launch. So if people are interested, then they can see all the new galleries through that and learn a bit more about the story behind it.
Yeah.
So do put that link on.
We will share that as well. Yeah, indeed. Well, it's time to say bye-bye and say how much we've enjoyed the conversation. And thank you so much once again for joining us for this chat, Amanda. And my guess is that quite a few people listening to this will come away very inspired by not only your example, but, you know, the kinds of things that you've have achieved and showing what's possible.
Yes.
So thank you.
Honestly, we are so grateful. You know, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us because, you know, as I said, it's wonderful what you've achieved there. And the more people know about it and come to visit the museum, the better.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me on. And I will say just one last thing briefly. During the first lockdown, when I was off and I had to go on furlough and the project had to pause, which was really difficult for 3 months, the one thing that kept me going was listening to you guys. So thank you very much.
You are so sweet. Thank you so much. That is such a nice thing to say.
True.
Thank you very much.
That's lovely to hear. Thank you. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you, viewers, for watching. We'll see you all very soon indeed.
Take good care. Bye.